Hello and Kia ora. Yes, that's right. You're listening to the latest episode in the Bookbound podcast, and we're crossing hemispheres once more between Emma Byrne, an author and sweary scientist who's based in the UK, and Freya Daly Sadgrove, a poet based in Aotearoa, otherwise known to non-Maori speakers as New Zealand. Leading them in their discussion today, it's me. I'm their host, Georgie Codd. And what a privilege it was. You'll find out why in just a second, but this is a very open and quite deep and quite sweary conversation at times. So if you don't like swear words, probably avoid it. Also, a trigger warning, listener discretion advised. There are discussions here about trauma, including child abuse and suicidal ideation, and so I must make that clear now. If you think you might be affected by that, then look after yourself. Maybe press pause on this one for now. Without further ado, it's my great pleasure to introduce Freya Daly Sadgrove, who's going to kick this conversation off by just saying how she's feeling. It's been the lockdown period, it's been coronavirus, it's been an anxious time, and anxiety is at the forefront of all of our minds in this one. So, Freya, take it away.
Oh, man. Tired. Pretty, but also tired in like a really existential way, and not at all like physically. I've been getting a lot of sleep. I don't know. I'm also like kind of nicely a lot less sad. That's great timing really to be like in a in a significantly better space mentally, just to, so I'm very strong and can deal with the lockdown a little better than I might have even a year ago. So
yes, one of the things that I noticed myself as I have depression and complex PTSD is that in some ways, the beginning of lockdown, or just as that was about to happen, it felt like an event I'd been planning for my whole life. Like, oh, multiple possible scenarios that have to be planned for. Have to work out what the path of least regret would be. Have to deal with all this anxiety and kind of compartmentalize it while surviving. And then, bitch, please, I know how to do this. Did you have that kind of, hey, this is not my first everything's fucked up rodeo when this all kicked off?
Extremely. I feel like I've never related to anything more in my life. It felt like a depressive episode kind of at first, like, and it still kind of does in some ways. Like, some of the patterns of behavior are exactly the same, like not leaving the house obviously, but also like I'm drinking a lot more, even though I was already into the regular bevy, but no, yeah, it was very, it's so strange because like I had, I don't know, like everyone, heaps of plans for the year. And in fact, way more plans than I have had for many years because, I don't know, for the last heaps and heaps of years, I've been like dealing with or recovering from episodes of one kind or another. And then I kind of came out this year. I was like, 2020, here we go. I'm fine. I'm prepared. I've done all my what I need to do to be out ready in the world, living the life that I want to live. And then it's like, no, you got to go back and just like do the exact same thing you've been doing this whole time. But I do feel I do feel like I'm really good at it.
Yes. Yeah, I don't know about you, Georgie, with like anxiety and things that you've been phobic about in the past. Is this easier or worse for you, do you think, because of having had that experience of facing your fears?
Oh, I don't know. I feel like it's interesting writing a book about facing fears because people assume that I'm now an expert at facing fears, which I'm an expert maybe in thinking about how on earth do I face fears, but I'm still, I don't think, a person who knows
how to properly, or if it's even possible to get rid of a fear altogether. But like you guys, I don't know, I feel like anxiety is my permanent state of mind, and I don't really understand anyone who can exist on a daily basis without feeling anxious all the time. So it's quite weird that everyone's like, oh, anxiety is terrible and scary. And I'm like, but isn't that how you feel all the time? I don't know how you guys have been feeling about it, but yeah, that's my take on it.
Yeah, it's when I see people suddenly saying, oh, finding it really hard to focus on things, I'm finding it really hard to concentrate and to read. And it's weird. It's almost like I don't have enough capacity in my brain. It's like, yes, because your brain is busy doing other shit right now. And what it's doing is worrying about shit. Yeah. Hi, welcome to the world of the chronically anxious. But in some ways, I remember reading some tweets from John Ronson early on, so going, you know, there is this feeling of a sort of an earned competence here of, you know, yeah, I know what it's like I know how to pretend I'm not depressed, at least while appearing in a screen this big. Like, you don't know when I last cleaned my teeth. I mean, I didn't actually clean my teeth this morning. And you guys don't know whether or not this is dry shampoo, although I did actually get a shower yesterday. But so many of the rhythms of depression, of that kind of loss of structure and not really giving a shit about where mealtimes are and losing a little bit of the old routine of personal hygiene. So I'm very, very glad that we have two kids in the house, because that kind of keeps me a bit more structured than I think I would be.
I've kind of definitely lost all structure because I don't have a job. I'm on the sickness benefit. One of the things that just was the first to go out the door was the kind of structure that I'd imposed on my jobless life, which was like, I didn't have a proper job, but I had a lot of like work that I was doing. And now I don't have much work to do. Yeah. So, like, oh, I've got this so many hours in the day to fill up. I don't know. It was like immediately at the start of this, I was like, oh, all of my other concerns with life became like lower priorities. And I was just like, this is a time in my life and in the world where I need to like work real hard to just like be in defense mode in case like little depression sneaks in there, want to tell me some sad thoughts about how I have no worth. But it's okay, because I had so much therapy last year, so I can take it. But it is taking up all of my mental energy just to kind of like keep an eye on things.
I think that's the other thing that I noticed when I had postnatal depression, that the ability to spot those patterns early on is also a really useful coping mechanism of going, I know what this is. I'm not just tired. I am delusional to the point of concern about how much better off everyone would be without me. It's time to ask for more sertraline, please. And it's almost like, again, people facing this sort of feeling for the first time and going, it may not be normal for you, but it is not unprecedented, and there are ways through this. Let me help my sweet summer child who has never felt this shit in your life before. Let me be your guide to the awful thoughts. It's a weird feeling.
You guys, then, please be the guide to our audience who are watching, who haven't had these feelings of depression, maybe, or maybe have had them before, but not for such a prolonged amount of time, or anxiety. As I said before, I feel like everybody probably must surely be anxious a lot of the time anyway, but this is primo anxiety zone. So let's start with you, Freya. What are you doing to get you through, and like what would you recommend to the person who is anxious for the first time right now?
I get so nervous about these questions because I really don't want to like spout platitudes, even though some of them are totally legit. But like the main thing is I just have to be like, okay, every day is one day. The things that I like, so I'm much more kind of at risk of going like depressive than like my anxiety is kind of part of my depression rather than, and it's worsened by depression rather than being a nice little, tight little anxiety ball. It's like, I don't know, got some other stuff going on. But I just have to make sure that I, if I feel sad or if I feel scared or if I feel like everything is fucked up, I'm like, no, that's a fair enough reaction to this situation. And I have to actually let myself feel those things, because it's when I am like, no, like when I push it down that it, you know, that it builds pressure. And then I go crazy. I'm just like, take every day as it comes. I'm trying not to be like grumpy with myself for not really achieving that much. I'm celebrating the small things that I do achieve. Like, I made soup today. I'm incredible. I'm Hercules. I think the main thing is, like, I always think people who experience mental struggles are so, like, powerful. People kind of, I think that, like, neurotypical people are sometimes, like, there's the stigma around mental illness is like, oh, it's a weakness or whatever. But I'm like, no. Like, it's amazing that we're all still alive and like living our lives. Like, it's so powerful and strong of us. So I don't know. I like to focus on those things if I'm like losing it.
What about you, Emma?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of that resonates for me, particularly the idea that, you know, we've made it this far, with the little voice inside your head that's going, walking off a cliff, what a good idea, everything would be so much more set. It's like, no, bitch, shut up, I hear you, I know what you're doing, you're just tired or angry. Or someone once told me that, is it HALT, hungry, angry, lonely, tired, never make any decision, including whether or not to top yourself, when you're hungry, angry, lonely, or tired. It's like, oh, that's quite useful. Bizarrely enough, like, just stupid things, like, this is going to sound so platitudinous, but making sure that I am hydrated and well-nourished, even if I don't feel like eating. Things that have worked in the past is going, I don't have the energy to make soup today. Well done, Freya. That is fucking Herculean. But I will at least make sure that I have some protein shakes and a banana and something that will, you know, give me some energy. Because when you start to starve your body, it goes into crisis mode and starts having even more anxiety. If I'm feeling lonely, I'll spend time with some people. And it doesn't matter if those are imaginary people. It can be people in the television or people in a book. If I'm tired, I will sleep. You will feel, particularly if you've had the COVIDs right now, you will feel knackered. Anxiety is really exhausting because your brain is doing so much processing. My coping mechanism for anxiety is to map all the possible futures and then map all of my reactions to those possible futures. And in some ways, this lockdown is my ultimate nightmare fuel, because there is no obvious end point that I can map for. I'm having to go back to, as Freya said, saying, what am I going to do today? Just focus on the next necessary thing and not much else. The other bit of advice that sounds a bit platitudinous, but that I've actually found really helpful, again, in times of anxiety, to stop anxiety metastasizing into depression and these feelings of worthlessness or helplessness, is to go, everybody's juggling. The trick is to know which balls are rubber and which ones are glass. Anything that will bounce, drop it. I need to pull out of an event. I need to extend my deadline. I need to not fucking clean the kitchen. Jesus, we're not going to die of botulism. One of the things that are most breakable. So for me at the moment, it seems like if I'm going to be a fucking ratty bitch, I need to go and be a fucking ratty bitch on my punch bag or on paper or to one of my friends. I do not need to be a fucking ratty bitch to my kids. If I am feeling really sad and anxious and concerned, I talk about it to the other adults in the house and see what we could maybe do about it. Again, don't take it out on the kids. Don't try to pretend I'm not feeling those things. And the other one, the feeling that I noticed was missing from your inventory, or at least only alluded to, was noticing when I'm fucking angry. Because I'm fucking angry a lot right now. I'm angry that Donald Trump is trying to pass off as a joke the idea that one could somehow clean oneself with bleach. I'm angry at the lack of PPE on the front lines. I am angry at the fact that this fucking lockdown is not hitting everybody equally, that people like me who can work from home, at least theoretically, are really fucking privileged, whereas the people who are driving buses or stacking supermarket shelves are in considerably more danger, and we don't seem to be giving enough of a shit about that. And for such a long time, I'd been trained in that, I think, typically feminine way of going, anger is so unbecoming and so repellent, and we should make people, particularly men, feel comfortable, that actually go, no, I'm really fucking angry about this. Buying a punch bag was the biggest acceptance of that set of feelings in myself, and going out and wailing the shit out of it is one of the best self-care hints I've ever had, because I think particularly as women, we have a tendency to take our anger and go, well, it must be my fault for feeling this bad about things. It must be my fault that I can't fix all of these problems. It must be my fault that I'm unequal to making this better. It's not up to us to fix the world. It's not up to us to make everybody else feel comfortable. And it is perfectly acceptable to be fucking angry about some of this stuff. Oh, I broke Freya. Sorry.
You broke me. No, that's just so legit. That's like stuff I've been trying to learn for so long. I don't know, it wasn't until a couple of years ago that I was like, oh, anger.
Yeah.
Oh, that's what that is. Like it most often, like I would unconsciously kind of translate it into self-hate or like despair. But so often it was like, yeah, a sense of injustice or whatever that I was totally not acknowledging is what it was, and I felt like I couldn't grapple with it in any kind of like public way. I'm so non-confrontational, and I'm like, I don't know, I'm still working on like getting a bit of a backbone, like when I need to stand up for myself and stuff. But yeah, I don't know, the social conditioning is strong and it's so hard to overcome.
Yeah, I read your essay where you talked about various things, but one of them about your reactions to condescending men and how in the moment there's that kind of freeze or friend reaction, but that the stage is a safer place sometimes to let these feelings out. How have you found that as a theatre maker? I definitely am attracted to, I've done sort of neo-burlesque, and I've done various on-stage things as a way of going, I'm allowed to speak in these circumstances. People have turned up to allow me to express myself, therefore I'm allowed to have a voice. Do you find that same sort of comfort in that?
Yeah, I've found lots of ways to like make fun of myself and put myself down for being a performer, because I have always been like, I was the show off kid and I was the attention seeker. I got made fun of heaps for it because that's what happens. But I mostly it was very run of the mill children, you know, making fun of each other, but some of it was like weirdly adult men. making fun of child me for wanting attention, which is kind of like, I think a lot about this idea of wanting attention it's so like pathologized or something, like it's so weird that attention seeker is like a pejorative thing, because I'm like, I feel like if someone's seeking attention, they probably need attention in the same way as like cry for help is so, it's like, why would you, if it's a cry for help, someone needs help, like, why is that a, it's like people brush off, you know, suicide attempts as cries for help, and I'm like, oh, what was I even talking about? I got lost.
So not necessarily reacting on your rage in the moment, but having that attention seeking, that the desire to do things that are notable and noticeable, how that can sometimes feel really not necessarily loud. And particularly, I was interested when you saying like adult men taking the piss out of you as a young kid. That sounds fucking nauseating. Who are those shits? Where are they? Let me kill them for you.
Dudes are assholes. it's a weird. That's a weird. It's like small stuff that really, because when you're a kid, you're like forming a personality, and like adults can put stuff in there that, you know, it's like if they're not that conscious like you are of like not putting those things of like maybe like taking the scary emotions to somewhere safe with other adults to kind of deal with, then you can like, you can fuck up a child real easily. You don't have to do much. Not to, I don't know, I think about this possibly too much. But I don't know. I think for me, like, getting on stage is being like, I don't know, I feel so at home in front of a room of people. I'm like, right, it's my time to like make the connections that I want to make with people, and take up some space and be like, here I am, big girl. Being who I want to be, or being characters I really don't want to be. But it's like, yeah, it's definitely a freeing thing to be able to like explore your emotions on in like a live format. Yeah.
Can I ask that transition to being the big girl on stage, then when the lights are off and you're leaving the stage, then what happens?
It depends. It depends on how it went. I can ride a high for quite a while if something's gone well. And often the way that I kind of, because I do a lot of like comedy stuff, like a lot of what I am doing on stage is comedy. So I get that immediate feedback of laughter. And if I get enough of it, boy, I can, it's like, it powers me up. But also there have been times when I've done what have been like quite good and memorable performances for people who've watched them and talked to me afterwards, that I have like, I don't know, because I've still done performance when I've been like in the depths. And some of them have just been like, I don't know, sometimes I come off the stage and I'm like, I need to go and be put in a bin for the rest of my life. I don't know, it just depends on where I am, but I'm like, always it's like being in the moment that is such a, on the stage, that's such a like releasing thing for me, because so much of the time I'm thinking about the future or I'm thinking about the past. And like analyzing it, you know, as we all do. It's only when I'm on stage that I'm like, here we are in the present moment. So yeah, it depends on how well I have set myself into that present moment, I think, afterwards.
What about you, Emma?
Yeah, very similar. And it's interesting, I remember we were chatting yesterday about chairing things and that idea of when you're about to do an event, that you sort of go almost into this fugue state of afterwards, you're like, oh, who was that sort of speaking through me, who took over, who responded in the moment? And I think there is something about that is very freeing about having to be in the moment, and having to, even if it's something that's scripted or semi-scripted, that you are, I think that's why I was really drawn to the sort of comedy burlesque stuff, is you're working an audience and you're trying to pull out responses from them. But yeah, you don't have space to be going, oh my God, have we got enough food in for the rest of the month? And when is have my invoices been paid? And oh my God, am I ruining my kids? And you can't. You have, it's like rock climbing. You have to focus on the next fucking handhold. And that's it. That's the limit of your attention. And that's actually weirdly relaxing for all of the other shit that's going on. And recently I got to do a show. A friend of mine wrote a bunch of pieces for the Vaults Festival in London called The Future is Mental. Little did we know. And the last bit was, so I was doing the lighting and the projection for it, but I was also in it. The very last vignette was this prime minister who was calling upon all men over the age of 70 to make the ultimate sacrifice for the good of all of the rest of us. And it was her satire on Pence and the March for Life. And she, you know, she'd written this fantastic script. There's lots of scripture stuff about the length of a man's days, of 3 school years and 10. And at that time, Tyre shall be forgotten for 3 school years and for 70 years, the span of a king's life. So you guys who are living over the age of 70, you're being very unbiblical right now. So make Jesus happy and fucking do one. And at the time, I was like, this is appalling. I have to try to get myself in the mindset of a woman who cares so little about making men feel comfortable that she would willingly and enthusiastically advocate for their euthanasia the minute they turn 70. And that was really interesting, not because I want to do that, I should point out, I'm not Dominic Cummings, but to get in the mindset of someone who's going, no, for the rest of us, this makes sense. I'm sorry it's shit for you, but the rest of us, you know, need a lower carbon footprint and less drain on the NHS, and for all of those, the pension funds to be released for all these women that are now asking to, you know, being asked to retire much later. Can you all just, you've had a really good run, you're a bunch of boomers, you didn't have a war, can you all just fuck off now? It's like, to be that thoughtless of other people's feelings, to go, I'm not here to make you happy or comfortable, how would that feel? And it was fucking heady. But I thought the satire was so broad. And then like 3 weeks later, we're talking about herd immunity and running hot. And it turns out that the satire wasn't actually that fucking broad at all. It was just a little preview of what our government was going to do. So that then made all of that feeling of what I had learned from the experience of being this truly execrable to the point of ridiculousness person suddenly went, oh no, that's not actually that ridiculous. Some people actually think this is a good idea. So maybe I'm rethinking all of my thoughts about whether or not this was a positive experience. I'm slightly worried that maybe Dominic Cummings was in the audience. But that's slightly solipsistic to believe that I actually caused the terrible government response here because someone saw me in some fringe theatre thing. That might be a little bit of grandiosity creeping in there.
I just interject here quickly and say that I was talking to a group of friends who suffer with anxiety and depression. That's obviously not why we're friends. There's plenty more going on in our lives for us. But everyone in the group at one point kind of raised a hand in, it was on WhatsApp, so like raised a yellow hand emoji and was kind of like, I feel like I might have actually caused coronavirus by my anxiety and worries, and because I'm an awful person and I keep thinking about it. Freya, you've just been reacted like with agreement there.
Yeah, I feel like everyone that I've talked to and me, everyone thinks they did something to contribute Mine was, I think I said in an email to a friend of mine, I'm excited to go to Edinburgh in September or August. I hope society doesn't collapse before then.
What did you do?
I did it. I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry, everyone. just like, anticipating the worst when it's like, because most of the time you're like, to treat your anxiety, you're like trying to like, be like, oh, what is the truth of the situation? And usually it's not the thing that you're like worried about happening. And then this time it was.
It does make that whole sort of sanity check, reality check, sort of cognitive behavioral shit really fucking tricky when you're sort of going, yeah, but how likely is it that in the depths of a global pandemic that some of the most powerful people in the world would start advocating policies that are actively harmful? Oh shit, no they are. Okay.
So we have done, or rather you guys have done a bit of swearing in this talk so far. And I'm aware that we've branded? Well, the festival has called this Language Woman. And obviously, Emma, you've written your book about how swearing is good for you. And let's talk about some swearing for a bit and see what happens. So, Emma, why is swearing good for us?
Yeah, I mean, there's a bunch of neurological reasons why swearing is different to the rest of language. It draws not only on things that in most right-handed Westerners anyway are on the left side of the brain, the kind of conscious language that we use. It also, if you stick people in fMRI scanners or make them wear those little EEG hats while swearing, while listening to swearing, you can see that there's also a lot of activation on the parts of the brain that process things like emotion and interpersonal relationships. And possibly because of that, possibly because it's allowing us to process emotion, or because it requires such a diffuse amount of neurological input, when we swear, we can withstand pain and demonstrate far more stamina than when we're not. So the canonical experiment for this was done about a decade ago, I think, in Keele University. A chap called Professor Richard Stevens had his undergraduates stick their hand in ice cold water while swearing and while not, and found that you can keep your hand in ice water about half as long again while swearing than while using a neutral word. Since then, they've repeated that to see if you can show more stamina or lift stronger weights, whether or not minced oats, things like bum or willy or sugar, are any good. They're not. They have to be things that are emotive. And there is something about the existence of taboos in our language, about things that are uncomfortable, that is really important when it comes to the power of swearing. The reason we know that taboos are unnecessary, in fact, a taboo and the ability to express it are sufficient for swearing to arise. And we know this because of chimpanzees who have been cross-fostered into human families. And if you're cross-fostering a chimpanzee, if you want a chimpanzee in your home, you really have to potty train them, because they are filthy little bastards and they will throw their shit around as a means of communication. But there's a project called Project Washoe. A bunch of chimpanzees who were fostered together by Roger and Deborah Foots in the United States. And they potty trained all of these chimpanzees to the point where, you know, if they had an accident, they would lie about it. Or if they were out walking in the woods, they would wait until they were back in the compound to shit, even if it was really uncomfortable. But they also started using the same sign, the sign for dirty, everything to do with things that were scatological, in the same way that we use the word like shit, like you shit, Roger you shit, or this is shitty, oh shit. And also they would make shit jokes as well. They have that same sort of scatological sense of humour as my 4-year-old does, where everything is poo and wee at the moment. So that to me is glorious, this idea that as soon as you have a taboo, something that is emotionally potent and the means of expressing it, you will use the expression of it to try to drive emotions into the world, put those emotions out there and make people feel them without actually physically hurting them. There's some great research out of New Zealand and also Australia about what is called in the technical literature jocular abuse, I think it's what we call here in the UK BANTS with a Z, but this idea of the mutual roast, and that is really good for team building because you're demonstrating a degree of trust. You're saying, I know that you know that we're good enough friends that I'm not really calling you an asshole. So that's really fascinating as well. And I was really interested in what Freya writes about the art of the self-roast and how in New Zealand culture that this is a really big thing. And where you think that might, you know, does that help with staying comfortable when you are in awkward social situations? Is it a way of diffusing tension or making other people comfortable? Who benefits when you take the piss out of yourself?
It's definitely a tension relieving thing, but it's also tied up with our kind of, we do have a little bit of a national sensibility. Like, I don't know, like tall poppy syndrome. It's like massive here. It's like, I don't know. I think of New Zealand when I think of tall poppy syndrome, but that's, I don't know. Maybe that's, I don't know. I live here. But yeah, there's something about like, we all hate it when anyone's proud of themselves, which is like, it gets a bit tiring. And sometimes I'm like, sometimes it's like almost like a taboo sometimes here to be like, well, I am extraordinary, which is fun to play with, I think. And I do a little bit of that, but I also do a lot like in my poems, but I also do a lot of like, piss take of myself, which I don't know, I guess people just like, people find it easier to relate to maybe over here because it's just like, sometimes there's even like an element of competition to how much you can put yourself down. And it's like poetry readings and stuff, like poets are just so, oh, we've really got this thing. Like, and I'm sure this is actually just everywhere. Like, you know, and it's also especially a woman thing. We've all been told this as well, that we've been socialized to like apologize before we present something, like always apologizing in advance. And that is such a thing here. And I still have to, I have to so consciously work not to do it. And sometimes I'm like, it's got to a point where it's like, you can make a joke out of apologizing before a thing now, because it's like, it's such a trope. That like you can just reflect on yourself and then reflect on that and reflect on that and then, yeah, I don't know what it is exactly, but we kind of like it when people hate themselves here. Mm. It's kind of hideous, but it's also fun.
I'm trying to teach my daughter to not be too British about things. So I remember saying to my husband at one point, we just started dating and we were walking across Waterloo Bridge back in the day when you could do that. And I said, oh, you know, one of the things is that I'm really self-critical and I hate myself for that. And he looked at me like, yeah, oh shit, you're serious. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is when I signed up for therapy. But then I realized that there was both that some of this was to do with trauma, of course it was, but some of this is just how we are, how we're trained as women to sort of apologize for taking up space. So my daughter is hella into dinosaurs, and one of the Duplos that I got her is the Jurassic Park one, and so I have told her that this is Chris Pratt, and when she says Chris Pratt, it's all one word, this is Chris Pratt. And I love playing with her Jurassic Park Duplo because she'll sit there and she'll go, no, Chris Pratt, get back in the wheelbarrow. Chris Pratt, you're being very annoying. Chris Pratt, sit there. I've told you to sit there, Chris Pratt. And I'm like, never, never apologize. Never explain. If Chris Pratt is not doing what Chris Pratt is meant to do, you tell him. You find your voice, my darling. So Chris Pratt is now my little avatar, my little sort of comfort blanket. If Chris Pratt was behaving like this, what would my daughter say? So Duplo Chris Pratt is here with me. It's kind of like my little totem. But yeah, Frey, you were saying as well that Lego is kind of one of your little friendly coping mechanisms for the isolation. I haven't started talking to Chris Pratt yet, I should point out, but I'm probably only like 48 hours away from having a deep and meaningful. But who have you got, Freya?
Yes, I have my Lego, although I don't think of my Lego as quite as alive in the same way as I do my other toys, which is really like technically embarrassing. Like, I probably should be embarrassed, but I'm not embarrassed. Like, this is, I don't know. I feel like a lot of my kind of approach to like empathy was kind of shaped by stuff like the Velveteen Rabbit and Winnie the Pooh. And I have my little toys. They're real. I have to apologize to them if they fall down. But also I feel like, especially during lockdown, I've kind of, and also actually I feel like the seeds were sown in therapy, funnily enough. I'm kind of on my team now. I'm kind of my friend now, which is like, I don't know. It's maybe sounds, I don't know how that would sound to someone who has always been their friend or who has never thought about that. But like, I have not been my friend for a long time. And like, we're just starting to like get to know each other quite well. And it's like, I'm almost like, oh my God, am I getting like a new brand of mental fuckery? But no, I'm just like, so I'm having a lot of chats with myself at the moment. Like, I mainly live in a little, I call it the stable. It was once a stable. It's like a little building. And so I'm alone in there a lot of the time. So I do just have chats. We just have little chats.
Yep.
That sounds absolutely wonderful. I'm really interested to ask you both, and I'll ask you first, Freya. We've been talking about parents a bit during this chat. What do your parents and family think of your like taboo breaking and how you're working in that?
Oh, they're funny. Like, my mum finds, this is my book, which is available like online if you're in the UK, but from Victoria University Press. And my mum finds it very, very hard to read. I think my whole family does, because it's a lot about just like being messed up, sad, and like having very difficult times in relationships and stuff. And so there's heaps of swear words. There's sex, there's like suicidal ideation. It'd be intense to read, in the same way that it's intense to talk to people you love when they are talking about like wanting to hurt themselves or whatever. Like, it's full on, but they cope with it. My mum once sent my nana a poem of mine, and that was published in a magazine, and she was like, yes, well, you know, just beware, because it did make me blush, and it's a little bit, just so you know, it's just a bit risque. And my nana read it and was like, what are you talking about? It's fine. Like, she can do what she wants, which was really great. I loved that for nana. My nana is a real hard case too. She uses language in extremely funny ways, and breaks a lot of taboos all the time. But yeah, I don't know. They find it hard, but they get through it. And I think that they've recognized that like, part of it is like, I needed to write what I needed to write. And if I'd censored it, then it wouldn't be what I needed it to be. So they're really supportive. They're like, my whole family is just like lovely, long-suffering cheerleaders.
What about you, Emma, with all your swearing that you do?
Yeah, so my family of origin, not so much in contact with anymore. In fact, my father in November was finally released after yet another spell in jail for being a fucking nonce. So part of me, and he's over 70. And I'm still, so it's a long and depressing story. He's been to jail for some of the shit he did to me while I was growing up, but there's still more that I just want to see banged up for the rest of his life. And I've been pushing West Yorkshire Police and pushing West Yorkshire Police, and like, yeah, I mean, we'll get to it, but it's historic. It's like, no, but he drove 200 miles to try to abuse an 8-year-old, which was actually a police officer pretending to be an 8-year-old. Went to prison for 4 years for that, and it's like, can we bang him up again before he comes out of prison? No, could do. But he's a guy over 70, and the idea that I'm under house arrest right now is a hell of a lot easier because I know that he's under house arrest too. So again, that whole thinking you caused COVID, I've been talking to my counsellor about this, and I'm going, I know that this would be solipsism in the extreme to believe that my brain conjured up the coronavirus to keep my dad indoors until he dies. But my God, it is the only fringe benefit. So in terms of my parents, I don't give a shit what they think. But in terms of my kid, people keep asking, like, since you became a parent, so I finished like the last few pages of it, so I was bouncing on my yoga ball to like, just stay inside for another week, baby, stay inside for another week. Mama's got a deadline. And I sent off the book, and then she was born, and then it was a year of, you know, sort of editing, proofreading, binding, selling. And so by the time I was doing this sort of initial round of book festivals and things, she was a year old, and people were like, surely becoming a parent has changed what you think about swearing. I said, I'm not sure that it has. Or, how will you feel when your child swears? I don't know. And then about a year later, my daughter must have been just over 2 years old. We'd gone to a very family-oriented resort in Lanzarote. It's one of those where they have the sort of the buffet with the chicken nuggets and everything for the kids. Lots of high chairs. And because it was so busy and people walking around with plates of hot food, I had stuck her in a high chair, and it's the first time she'd been in a high chair for about 3 months at that point. And I was like, I'd explained, you know, I don't want you running around, and I know you want to run around, but it's very dangerous. You sit in this high chair, and then we'll go for a run around after we've had dinner. And she eats her pasta and her chicken nuggets and all the other beige foods that she loves. And then she turned around and she went, Mama, you get me out of this fucking high chair. Okay. Yes! Brilliant! Because everyone else's kid was throwing their pasta on the floor and screaming and kicking shit, and my daughter was just like, I'm bored. Get me out of this fucking high. And the intonation was perfect too. I was so fucking proud. And I was like, yep, sure, Mama's just gonna finish this large glass of wine, and then we'll go for a run around outside. But she used her words, and she used her words correctly. And I've pointed out that, you know, don't teach the babies in nursery these words. Maybe don't say them to Nana and Granddad, and maybe you talk about your feelings instead of the word itself. I'm just trying to bore her out of swearing. But I didn't freak out. I was actually really fucking proud of her for finding the right way. She's not sworn at Chris Pratt yet, at least that I know of. But she has definitely sworn when things have been frustrating. And it turns out that I'm actually fucking cool with that, because I never want her to lose her ability to express the fact that she is uncomfortable with something. It's so easy to crush that, and it won't be me that does it.
That is such a heartwarming way, unsurprisingly heartwarming, like, no swearing child, to end this conversation.
Hold me close.
Hold me.
Yeah, I need you the most.
That was Emma Byrne, Freya Daly Sadgrove, and me, Georgie Codd, speaking together for the Bookbound 2020 Festival. If you've been affected by any of the issues in this conversation, that's completely understandable. You won't be alone and you shouldn't be alone. We're going to link to some helplines, advice lines, services that you could use if you're going through issues and you need to connect. And connecting can make a hell of a difference, I tell you. That's something I've learnt a lot through making these episodes. Another note as well on that theme is that we are raising funds in aid of the UK-based mental health charity Mind, and would also direct you towards Changing Minds NZ if you're based in New Zealand or Aotearoa. Please, if you have some money to spare, this is an excellent thing to support. There are so many people going through mental health issues right now, probably more than ever. And the stats aren't out yet, but let's be honest, coronavirus is taking its toll. So consider donating and look up Just Giving Bookbound to send some cash to Mind. Normally at this point I would say on the next episode, but I can't quite do that this time because I'm not 100% sure what the next episode is going to be. We're working on it, we're talking to some people, we're doing some homework, and we're taking a bit of a break as well, but there will be more. In the meantime, if you've missed any of our 22 amazing conversations between authors, then go back and have a listen. Also, please do give us those wonderful 5-star reviews. They make a hell of a difference. And rate us like that, like I said. I already said that. Review us, that's what I meant. Review us, and also you can subscribe. So when we are ready with our next episodes, you'll be the first to know about them. The Bookbound podcast team is me, that's Georgie Codd, hello and goodbye, plus Claire Reed, more importantly, God, done so much editing work, and Felicity Quick, our social media guru, and Beatrice Bazell, who is just keeping us whipped into shape on the straight and narrow. Love them all. Thank you, guys. We all also love our theme tune, which is Wonder Under by the Glad Rags, and which is kindly donated by the Free Music Archive. Right, signing off for the moment, but we'll be back. Look after yourselves in the meantime. Bye. It's no-